context, Caroline Casey. So, all of us here together, we are all navigating grief. May collapse make us all kinder and kinned. So we welcome the return of Erin Caffell, author of The Mourner's Bestiary. We did two shows on that last season. And now her novel, All the Water in the World. The world as it was, the world as it is, and the world that's coming for all of us. Erin Caffell is a writer and musician. Her work on loss, oceans, and extinction has appeared in 8 million publications. The memoir, The Mourner's Bestiary, and now the novel that we are featuring, All the Water in the World. Erin Caffell has produced some of the most powerful writing on the ecological crisis that I've read anywhere, says Naomi Klein. All the Water in the World, this novel, when the world collapses, will our love for each other. Each sentence is a treasure. Yes, it's true, it's true. Read this and be changed, says Renee Denfield. So welcome, Erin Caffell.
Thank you so much for having me back. What a joy.
It is a joy. And I just, for serious whimsy, want to begin with the movie Flow, which you saw, right?
I did. I saw it with my family. I think
wow.
That's such a brilliant movie.
It's a companion to your book, really, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I just think the images are so incredible, and it was really kind of like somebody had reached into my novel and my imagination of water over the course of the 10 years that it took me to write it, and then it had produced this all-animal version of it, which is just spectacular. It was such a gift to be able to be there and to know that that zeitgeist is happening across the planet between me and, it's Lithuanian, am I correct, I believe, or Latvian.
Latvian, right? It's like Latvian. Yeah. I was tricked by synchronicity into watching it. I turned on the TV thinking it was news, and I go, oh wait, what is this thing that I've never heard of? Oh my god! It was halfway through, so I rewound it, and I was like, whoa! And it's won every animation in the world. I want to tie it to your book because it. I've been raving to everybody, because I go. One, it's a vacation from humans, it's all animals. And there is no language, but there is much communication.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Why I tie it to your book, and why we need it so much is how do we all navigate collapse? The movie addresses that, and you address that too. And the answer is, kindness and kinship in the movie Flow. But and then, like your book, which I return to over and over again, it's I've watched Flow many times, because after I watch the news, I go, I need to cleanse myself and watch Flow again. I do. Yeah, but so how shall we navigate this grief? And you're so good at that in The Mourner's Bestiary and this one too. And then grief is love, really, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what's beautiful about watching that film is that there is, I love the central metaphor of a boat. Obviously, boats come up in both of these books over and over again. And Flow, so much of it is, who do we find ourselves on the boat with after everything that we know has disappeared, right? And what are the things that we're drawn to? What are the battles we have to fight? How do we let each other go? How do we accept the presence of things that are larger than ourselves? What do we save? I mean, there's that one creature that just keeps trying to collect bottles and objects and, what is it that we're taking with us if we have to set off away from everything that we know and love? And I'm certainly not the first writer or artist to think about it, but I love that that's a question that is so resonant in the moment that we're in right now.
Yes, right. And, exactly. And how shall we navigate? That's also the rising tide, the water, and in Flow and in your book, the hypercane, Right, because I, you know, when you open this wonderful book that we are offering for a pledge of $150 as a pledge incentive to keep the station alive so we can keep hearing Aaron Koffel, you know, I'll just put this out now, 800-439-5732 or kpfa.org. It's so wonderful. It's such a powerful, good book. But again, you know, what sustains us, what keeps us alive, and the community of the grieving, and the community of the grieving in the world is huge, you know, and there's Gaza, and like in your book, you know, when the characters finally get some fresh water, right? Every time I go to my little spring water vessel, which is also still, as the woman who sold it to me said, you know, spring water is full of plastic too, but mm-hmm. I am so grateful to drink water, you know, and mm-hmm. and I think reading your book, All the Water in the World, you know, does increase our gratitude. We're not quite yet at the hypercane. I'm going to hand that back to you, but yeah. you do just right away jump in. I go, this book is just setting forth like, oh, here we go. What's coming to us?
Yeah.
And the hypercane, of course, that makes sense. The monster in the water. Do you want to tell us what the hypercane is and how it feels like it is coming?
Yeah. I mean, the hypercane is something that when I was first researching this book and thinking about what happened to New York City, where the book is set, where I was born, where my mother was raised, that place, you know, I was trying to research what it would look like under the worst case scenarios. And one of the things that I came across in that research, as I was thinking about storms, as I was trying to write my way into the storm that sort of sets the entire plot in motion, I started researching this theoretical idea that scientists were talking about, which was the hypercane. This idea of, you know, what if we passed the hurricane scales that we know to this point in science and in, you know, Earth history, what would it look like? And it was a purely theoretical idea and one that I borrowed for, again, my worst case scenario, sort of post-climate collapse book. But, you know, the closer we get to the tipping points and the sort of no return moments for our planet, the closer we actually get to a hypercane arriving. And I think we saw something very close to it this summer over the Gulf of Mexico. I remember really vividly that footage. Oh yeah, of course, I'm sticking through that to the end. accuracy matters in science. You know, in that moment where the newscaster or the meteorologist that was talking about the hurricanes that were coming up from the Gulf to hit Florida began crying on air. And I just remember that as such a, you know, repeated, people were sending it to me all the time. That was because this theoretical outer edge of terror within these large storms was starting to be approached. And, you know, I wanted to begin that way because part of what I wanted to do in writing this book was to make sure that if there were scientists that were reading it, it wouldn't be inaccurate enough to take a scientist out of reading this book. That's a big love letter to scientists. Because my mother was, I think, as we've talked about in our previous interview, my mother was a hydrogeologist for the Environmental Protection Agency in Massachusetts. And so much of my understanding of water and of science and theories is all from being raised while she was getting her degrees and, you know, spending all of our time watching movies where scientists are the heroes. And watching lots of geology movies with her where if anything was inaccurate, she would just immediately call it out. That volcano wouldn't work like that. So making sure that the hypercane was there and was rooted in a possible future reality was really meaningful to me.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Right, hypercanes could pull energy from the warmer water and spawn tornadoes and locally intense downdrafts. The rain could be sideways or include hail. Could have a very fast rate of precipitation. It could have the most destructive winds possible, ranging up to 200 miles per hour. Yeah, that seems plausible, right? Again, you know, just to acknowledge, you know, in every way right now, we are in a dangerous time, which is why it is good to have community. And the churlish removal of so much support of everything that we need, you know, mutual aid, and the government, our outsourced Saturn, you know, removing support in every churlish way. It's like, oh my God, you know, And I saw on your Blue Sky account too that you were mentioning about Medicaid cuts, right? And how crucial that is for people with kidney issues and any other things. If you want to say, you know, what's on the table right now with Medicaid.
Yeah, I mean, a huge inspiration for my memoir and a thing I think about all the time is just how influential the addition of protections within Medicaid and Medicare for kidney patients are for the survival of my family. It's been the thing that, you know, when kidney care began to be protected as what is often referred to as the only socialized medicine for an organ in America, because we obviously don't have socialized medicine, those protections of Medicare and Medicaid are as close as we come, but the protections that are available to people with kidney disease made it possible for us to move from how things were when dialysis was first invented and brought to the United States in the 1960s, where there were rationing panels that decided who got care and who didn't within hospital systems. And they were done as thoughtfully as possible, and they were made up of local citizens and doctors, and but they still went through and assessed what the worthiness of each individual patient was to receive dialysis care. And in researching my book and kind of looking at the fact that the protections that protect my family from an incurable genetic disease that we've had for 150 years in our genetic line, and which may flow forward for many more generations. You know, in researching that, I was also noticing that that decision to protect kidney patients by legislation at the federal government level was happening at the same time that the Clean Air and Clean Water Act were being enacted at the federal government level. And so talking about Medicaid, it feels to me the same as talking about the larger question of what kinds of protections do we owe the vulnerable, and whether the vulnerable is someone like me who has an incurable kidney disease that will eventually put me on dialysis or send me to get a kidney transplant, or it's, you know, the plankton that live in the Long Island Sound but deserve not to have pollution dumped into their ecosystem to the point of asphyxiation. Like, I don't actually think that those two arguments are any different. And part of writing The Mourner's Bestiary was essentially trying to do a long-form argument for empathy towards people and animals and other creatures that are caught in these kinds of tides of decisions where we pull the rug out from Medicaid. And, you know, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of people all across this country whose lives will be ended or irrevocably changed by a decision to separate them from their care. I'm only telling the story of my own family and how being able to access dialysis has made our lives possible. My books aren't possible without dialysis being protected by the federal government.
Right. Well, that's one of the realities in the metaphor of the ocean and Neptune, dreams, vision. We're all in this dream together. It is all one thing, the community of the grieving, you know, all of that. And, you know, and you know, you write early in the book, the world as it is, right? The world as it is. And the world as it was, and we're right in that transition. And you know, mention in the narrative going, well, Miami was gone, you know, and Boston built seawalls, and Washington was flooded, but the people in the government took to boats, right? And you got that's all gone. And you write, the world as it is doesn't work if you don't have people. Father told me, and you have to be kind. People who don't know that get lost, capital L. Lost people don't know what it means to be human, is to care about other humans. They forget that a better world is coming. And then your character says, that's why we made Amen. That's why we made Amen. We keep, to keep the collections, we keep them because we have a duty to the future. Do you want to just describe what Amen is, where they first came out?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I was obsessed with natural history museums as a child, which should come as no surprise to you, having read my book, which is obsessed with fish. I also was raising a child, going to the Field Museum here in Chicago every day, pretty much as often as we could, at least a couple of times a week until kindergarten started. And so I was already in my imagination spending a lot of time in the space of museums that protect scientific discovery and history and all of the possibilities and also all of the mistakes of what we've tried to discover as a species. And I set the book there with a collection of folks who had stayed behind after the collapse to try and make sure that all of that information was retained. I was really interested in the fact that this has happened over and over again. Right? This is not a new story. But as I was writing the book, I did some reading deeply into the history of the Siege of Leningrad, where the museum curators in the Hermitage stayed behind during the siege for the entire 3 years and chipped ice off of the masterpieces and ate restorers' paste and, you know, tried to protect what was left. And they weren't the only ones. And, you know, if you look into that period of time, I actually just listened to a wonderful podcast called Gastropod, which was all about the seed saving library that was essentially across the square from the Hermitage that most of the people trying to save that incredible history of seeds, many of them died trying to protect the seeds rather than eat them and survive. So there's just these incredible histories. The Iraq War is another great example of people, you know, curators returning to the museum, the National Museum there, and trying to protect the antiquities from looting. It's a duty to the future that I think happens to us when collapse comes. It's part of this idea that I think is really well articulated in Rebecca Solnit's book, A Paradise Built in Hell, where we have this idea that collapse and destruction means that people become less altruistic, and actually most of the record shows us that that's not the case at all. And so I wanted to tell that story. I wanted to set up a group of people living on the roof of the American Museum of Natural History and spending their days working to make sure that there was this huge body of knowledge that was available to the world that they imagined emerging after the worst case scenario.
Right. And we have these, William Irwin Thompson used to write about Lindisfarne, you know, places where knowledge was kept to that it survived the Dark Ages. And we go, in Palmyra, a place dear to my heart in Syria, the keeper of the museum there died protecting it, died protecting the museum. We go, right, what is important? And then there's beautiful things in Amun the Museum, where the young girl character sees the indigenous house. You'll have to remind me what it's called, and goes, "Oh, I'd like to live there." What is that indigenous house?
Yeah, one of the longhouses is a little diorama that you can actually visit if you go to AMNH. And, you know, I think there's so many moments within. I mean, it's a huge struggle in museum keeping right now in the science and practice of it, in terms of trying to return materials to their rightful homes, their rightful owners. And that's going on in AMNH right now. And I wanted to make sure that when I was talking about the history of making museums work, I didn't leave that story out. It's too important to be able to recognize that, you know, museums are not perfect places. And I think, you know, that's connected to this story that I also want to tell. You know, when you're writing a dystopia, you're basically married to the idea of utopia, because there's no dystopia without utopia. You're not apart from these kinds of imaginations of the possible worst case scenarios, but also what do we make as the beloved community or the utopia that we're striving towards in the face of collapse? And I was raised by somebody who was really interested in utopian communities and made Shaker furniture for the entirety of his life. And he really reaffirmed to me on a regular basis that utopias fail. And so I didn't want to set up a false utopia in the way that the folks in Amen relate to the collection, or build what they're going to build next. I wanted it to be as clear-eyed as possible in terms of what museums have to offer, where would the longing associate itself? The longing for the canoe, the longing for the longhouse, right? But also, how do we carefully navigate what that has done to us as a culture?
Well, and looking back into the past, you know, there they are in the museum, is their last little before it too gets flooded. But looking to the past for the canoe that they use, they have to break the glass to get it out. You know, it's again, we're looking backwards. It's like Deborah Felmuth in Syria in Vermont says, in the Middle East, we're gazing at the past and the future we don't know. And she said, we're crafting the future by gazing at the caravan of our past mentors. I always love that, you know, and so
that's
in a very real
phrase.
Way. In a very real way, you know, they're in the museum and they're gazing at the past mentors of people who lived in a respectful way with houses and such. You know, we're looking backwards to that, you know, at this time of great loss. You know, so already, you know, spoke with somebody yesterday in Wisconsin, bald eagles are dying of bird flu.
Yes.
She noticed, you know, going out to the bird feeder, fewer birds. You know, and I'm, you know, I'm still feeding my birds. You know, going peanuts. Okay, everybody, safe distancing. there you go. But you know, it's everywhere. I mean, everywhere, whether people know it or not. And I also just want to do a shout out to books. I'm so grateful to have this actual book in my hand. You know, and realizing, you know, growing up, I read it like a crazy person, and it's like, oh, I haven't been reading as much, but I want to, you know, and I did mention to you that yes, my sister died on February 1st, my cousin died last Thursday, and my beloved brother, they're all beloved, died on Saturday. He was a writer of books, and his house had thousands of books, and he'd read them all. And I said to you backstage, you know, as I was with him as he was dying, just breathing, and so his daughters and his wonderful, wonderful former wife. May we all be blessed with former spouses who show up. You know, and I'm gazing at a book right in front of me above his head called Lifeboat. Well, that's really apt. And I remember watching the movie Lifeboat with him with Tolu Bankhead. It's a memorably pretty great book, but Lifeboat. Yeah. And I realize your book is a lifeboat. You know, may we think of Pacifica Radio as a lifeboat. Maybe we're crafting our lifeboats, and it looks like a great book, a history of courage, cravenness, and survival at sea, Lifeboat. My brother did write a book that won the National Book Award about navigating a huge hurricane, which is something that he knew how to do. So we're all in this dream together, right? And then our personal grief, and you know, and you said, "I'm so sorry you had so much grief." It's like, well, we all participate. Yeah. We're all participating in this hugeness, and you know, and having three people die, death is not easy, and these are people who had every kind of care and safety possible, and then we extend that to everybody and to, you know, to Gaza and Khartoum and I mean just everywhere in Sudan, and go, yes, I mean the exit from life should be tended and calm, you know, with these prayers that we want, and I love also early in the book, I guess it's if things ever get back on track. Right, I love the word kilter. Right, we usually say off kilter, but I've discovered that kilter means, you know, in order and calm. And we go, yes, we've been off kilter. We want kilter. If we ever, if things ever get back on track, if we ever pull it out of the fire, Noni, I bet you'll be a scientist, a studier of the bits of things that end up telling a kind of awful and beautiful truth. You can feel the truth of small things in your bones, like you can feel all the weight of water, and it will take someone like you to heal it up. I love that as a kind of prayer invocation to the reader to dedicate. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think I was also sort of speaking back generations to my mother and my grandmother, who both were scientists, and forward to my kid, who's working on a science degree, and to my own, you know, the part of me that just is fascinated with the small things that, you know, you don't feel when you're staring in a tide pool that you understand necessarily the keys to the universe, but it is one of the keys to look at the small things and to add them up. And that intention and that attention is important even if your world is collapsing. And I think, you know, since you're going through this huge level of grief, and since I think of both of these books that I've written that have come out this year as books about grief, the primary emotion that I'm navigating in both of them. And you know, I think that there's this story about grief that, well, first that it has an end point, which it doesn't. It's a spiral, and it always comes back around to find us in a new place, wherever it finds us, when it finds us. And also that when you're in a space of grief, it crowds out all the spaces for joy and wonder and attention. And I love that even in this chaos and this collapse that my characters are living through, there's still this insistence that attention to being paid to the small things, the small details that make up the world, is actually part of liberation. It's part of survival. And I've found that to be true in my own life, that every time I've been caught up in grief, one of the things that's helped me to move through it is to be able to focus my attention outward, but towards something that would seemingly be inconsequential, you know, that is deeply consequential, like the tide pool.
Yeah. And I remember Martin Prechtel, friend of show years ago, would say, you know, he'd forgotten when he got back to this country after 25 years in Guatemala that Americans know so little about grief. And he said, yeah. For lack of grief, we'll go to war, right?
Yeah,
your books, you know, are dedicated to navigating grief, which is so crucial. You know, our language, you know, it's like we don't process grief. You process cheese, and it's never good. You know, we absolutely, as you say, we navigate grief, and it's never ending. You know, nor should it, because it is kinship and love, and poignancy is kinship, and intimacy. Yeah. You know, and I think your book and your dedication and any of us who are diving deeply into grief, it brings you up into all the grief in the world. I had so wanted Biden to, like, well, he did on his last day get, you know, we got Leonard Peltier home. That was a good thing. But I so wanted Biden. He was trained for this, and he just didn't do it. I wanted him to speak to Israel and to Gaza, and to go, the community of the grieving crosses human man-made borders. Let us unite the community of the grieving. And so, in a way, your book and all of us, too, going, you, the community of the grieving is vast, and it's kinship.
Yeah.
And let's honor that, you know, just, ooh, ooh. And so every page you say, we're going to bury my brother on Mardi Gras Day. And I go, that's festive. All right, well, the New Orleans people really know how to do it.
Oh, yeah.
I wish there was.
They would know how to, yep, that's absolutely apt.
So, you can say the person wasn't there, only the body under the soil. Bodies of people we love die. We leave them. Something of them remains in us. Something we have to keep like we would a fossil, a story no one remembers, a logbook. Whoops, I have to adjust my there we go. Oh, there we go. We're back somehow. Okay. And I often say, you know, we cannot live through the dead, but we can invite what we love in them to live through us. Does that hum
absolutely.
In yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, and I love that passage, because I feel like so much of what Noni's struggling with is what I think we all struggle with in the face of losing people, which is this, how much are they still part of us? How much are they still here? I mean, I've written with readers in mind who are not alive any longer in my family. And I do feel as if I'm sharing the process of making this work with them, and they are contributing as well, even though they aren't here. So I think we carry so much of folks with us, and, you know, so much of Noni's journey in this book is coming to a place where she feels that grief, like water, is this element that connects everyone, and actually it connects us to the living, and it enlivens the relationships we have with the living. You know, that question of the weight of water, right? One of the titles that we thought about for this book was The Weight of All the Water in the World, which I really loved, because I feel like that's actually what she's learning, is that it's that connective element that unites everyone, that is the thing that gives life and existence meaning, even in the face of death. And I was, you know, I've been on tour a bit for this book, more than the memoir. And one of the places that I went was to go to California, to go to LA. And I planned this trip far before the Palisades fires began, but they began on the day that the book was released. And so I spent 2 weeks writing to the bookstore that I was going to be going to say, you know, should I still come? Am I going to do more harm than good? How are your resources? I had a friend to stay with, so, you know, it was a surreal experience, and they kept saying, no, come, we would really like you to be here. So I did, and in that conversation, it was striking in so many ways, not only because, you know, the person I was in conversation with, Margaret Wappler, asked the audience who had packed a go bag in the last 2 weeks. And, you know, that's a big feature of the novel, and every single hand went up. But also because, you know, one of the questions that I got asked from the audience, and I think it's a question we're all asking ourselves, especially in the last 6 weeks that we've all just lived through, why are people so interested in ignoring climate collapse when it's here, when it's right in front of us? And this was a crowd of people who were living through an ongoing catastrophe when I was talking to them. And, you know, I think my gut reaction, which was nearly instantaneous, was, oh, everyone in America is afraid of death. Like, that is the anti-death cult that we are part of. And it insists that immortality and, you know, of a chemicalized, you know, your body never changes and you never age kind of version of it is the thing we're supposed to be striving for. And that everything that reminds us that we're going to die is only acceptable if it's part of a religious practice that is sanctioned and makes it very transactional and almost commercial. And so, like, I don't get surprised anymore that people don't want to think about the end of the cycles of nature that we've known, you know, for thousands of years. What I get surprised about is that we are still, even in our kind of activist circles, so, I don't know, not reticent to talk about it, but that we don't necessarily all go at the problem the same way, right? Which is, how do we get people to get used to the idea that everything is going to pass in a way that can keep them alive to being able to do what's necessary to keep survival on the table for the majority of us.
Right. And in Cataclysm, it was some smart commentator out of Los Angeles in the middle of the fires says, you know, quit this, you know, quibbling and criticism and conspiracy, you know, that here's where we are. You know, and we are frightened for our children. We're frightened for your children. And let me make it clear that what we're going through is coming for you. It's coming for all of us. And it's true, just to feel that, and again, the mutual aid, that quality of, you know, kinship. And you also say, look at us, or one of the characters, look at us, thinkers forced to be makers against our will. and you know, everybody, well, the go bag, right? You know, my great sort of grand wazir, you know, evacuating fire, and I go, what are you taking? And he goes, my favorite camera, my hard drive, and a toothbrush. You know, anyway, so it's like, you know, everybody, you know, in some form, you know, it's like, ooh, you know, and, you know, all of that. And then, you know, borrowing, and what shall we take with us? It's, the world as it is. We thought, you know, you're right, that we thought we'd choose the manner of our going, but the world as it is doesn't let you prepare. And we go, right.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, I think of these people as very prepared, even, and so were most of the folks that I was talking to in LA. You know, these are people who had probably thought about it. Somebody who's going to come to see one of my book talks is probably not somebody who's never thought about this question, right? But when it comes for you, what it looks like, what you get to take, what you have time for, whether you're home when it happens. I mean, there were so many people I knew who were, you know, traveling, and then the fire started. You know, and even, you know, this idea that we're going to find climate refuges where we are protected from the larger catastrophes. You know, I just talked to someone who lives in Asheville about that, right? Like, that's not a way that we can think about it any longer. We can't think about the material possessions. And, you know, and I wrote this novel partially to help comfort myself as a young single mom with a little kid. I live in a place where we don't have hurricanes. We have tornadoes, but we don't have hurricanes. And so I knew that particular scenario probably wasn't going to happen to me, but I needed to go through the thought experiment of what would it look like if the worst did come and I just had my small family to hold on to, and how would that feel? What would the emotional experience of that look like? And of course, I'm drawing on a lifetime of losing, you know, family members to an illness, but I'm also trying to think about, you know, the universal human experience of becoming a refugee and leaving in a boat because you can't stay where you are. And I you know, we're heading into a period, we're in a period, but it's the very beginning. It's the cusp of tremendous changes in terms of human migration as a result of
right.
what's happening in our weather systems. And this is going to be the universal story for more and more of us until it's more of the majority than the minority.
Yeah, no, I mean, it does address immigration because in the collapse which we're in and which your book brings alive, you know, the wariness of other people, right? The lost people.
Yeah.
You keep the doors locked,
yeah.
you know, and who can you save and who can you not? And you know, and it is the immigration theme. I love a friend, Steve Behrman says, the answer to the drug problem is easy. Improve reality. I go, that's great. The answer to the immigration problem is easy. Improve reality everywhere.
Everywhere.
Yeah. We're the improve reality party. It's so simple. Let's just do that. And then again, you do have the Buddha, you know, the woman in grief, and the Buddha says, you know, okay, you know, find these seeds from a house that hasn't
right.
known death. And she couldn't.
Yeah.
Every house knows death.
Yeah.
Every house knows grief. And to bring this up, you know, again, into
yeah.
our conversing and into our feeling and into our kinship, and to not suppress, you know, with distractions. And because there's, you know, no sense being distracted from what we're, the danger we're all facing. And we go, right, so every house knows death. And,
yeah.
you know, one of the books I read as a child, I remember I was sick in bed and I read this book on Minamata in Japan, and it was about the mercury poisoning of the sea. And the humans were so, like, how could the sea, our mother, our beloved, the provider of all nourishment, how could she poison us, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there are characters in the, and that stayed with me. I think I was 10 or 11 in bed reading it, going, right, oh my goodness, that was a long time ago. And you know, and that's something that your different characters navigate with, that Noni still loves the ocean, even though it's rising to take everything.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and again, you know, that goes back to being raised by my mom, who loved water so much and then spent the last 20 years of her career addressing pollution. You know, I think it's really possible to love something and then look at it clear-eyed and accompany it while you try to figure out how to help it heal. And I wanted to write about people who do that and hold on to that line of hope, that muscular, you know, enraged and loving hope that I think is really the key to helping us navigate this moment.
Yes, and then there's a poignant part: bees will keep us safe, right? Bees will keep us safe, and at some point you see, they see the bees. And they're like, where are the bees going? They escaped from their hive. Where were they going? they will, and then you say.
Yeah.
About the insects, and use a phrase, because one of my favorite shows from 800 million years ago was Joanne Locke, The Voice of the Infinite and the Small, Healing the Human-Insect Relationship. I'm like, oh boy, do we really need that?
Mm-hmm.
And you go into, you know, the loss on every level, you know, that we're experiencing now, and with those to whom we've outsourced power, just full of sociopathic cruelty, cunning with no empathy. Right, and your book is really a calling forth of empathy.
Yeah.
All right. I know you have another event. I've signed up for it. So
okay.
I'm gonna reluctantly let you go, but I know we have more planned, because this is such a rich book, and I'm going to be dedicated in touting it right now for our station to stay on the air so that we can continue to have a community here. So thank you very much, Erin Castle. Is there any one last thing you want to say
thank you so
at this
moment? No, just I'm so grateful for these conversations. They're very special. And
oh,
I'm glad that your station exists to make them happen. So I'm holding out hope for your community to come together to continue to protect it.
Yes. No, that's absolutely wonderful. Thank you so much, Erin Castle. We will be speaking very soon again. I'm so glad that we've ensured that. That's wonderful. Okay.
Good.
All right, team. Let's dive in. We're offering Erin Castle's wonderful book, All the Water in the World, as a pledge enticement, as a magnetizing enticement for a pledge of $150 by calling 800-439-5732. or online, kpfa.org. Many, many enticements and presents to look for there, but I'm really just featuring two: All the Water in the World by Aaron Kafel for a pledge of $150. And last week's guest, Microdosing for Health, Healing, and Enhanced Performance by James Fadiman and Jordan Gruber for $150. Grief and microdosing, it goes really well together. So I want to just again encourage, let's get on the board here by calling 800-439-5732. We're dark of the moon. We're at the dark of the moon right now. New moon Thursday night. There we go. At 9 plus Pisces, whose image is aviator, master of the high realms, sails across the skies, setting in motion projects that will benefit the next seven generations. It's like, that's what we're doing. That's what we're doing here, team. You know, pledge for acknowledging collapse, acknowledging grief, grief as love, as fuel for our mutual aid and our kinship. And it's dangerous out there. And this station, KPFA, and the network, KPFK, hello there, you know, and the Visionary Activist Show, it is community. And we are discerning the difference between community, mutual aid, and a cult, because a cult is the toxic mimic of community. And by Jiminy, we have outsourced authority to the Inquisition oligarchy, griftocracy, cult, right? And can't talk anybody out of a cult. However, we are at an opportune time, O team, you know, and that's why it's so useful to gather, because the power of awakened betrayal is enormous, and it's sweeping the land, and it's crossing borders. People are like, oh my God, oh my, stripping everything, and there's education going on. Like, I didn't know Medicaid did that. I didn't know I needed that. I didn't know, you know, the sheer churlish cruelty. And so when we call 800-439-5732, you know, any amount is wonderful. You know, again, it's a dedicated dynamic, you know, and that's part of this power right now of dedication. What are we dedicated to? So just, you know, when you call 800-439-5732 or online kpfa.org, you know, in your heart, go, I'm dedicating to kinship. I'm dedicating to have community, as other wonderful teammates on this station have mentioned, like Pacifica, unlike NPR, does not take government money, can't threaten us with that, ha ha. Although there is a, you know, a kind of, you know, enemies list, but we are here together, and the power of awakened betrayal, you know, it invites us to extend kinship and grief, you know, to compost people going, well, you voted for those people, and it's like, no, storytelling, embracing, we're all in this thing together. It's part of Neptune, dreams, vision, imagination, we're all in this. And I love from previous show a million years ago, we've been doing this for 28 and a half years, that the economist saying, you know, all of our metaphors for money are all water, currency, cash flow, liquidity, rising tide, you know. And I go, oh, this could be very good news for mystics, you know. And I invited him to extend that. And I go, you know, okay, extend it. That's wonderful. Oh, thank you. Thank you, team. Nadine pledging for microdosing. Steve and Novato pledging for kindness. That's wonderful. All right, we're on the board. Let's keep it rolling. 800-439-5732, you know, kpfa.org. Pledge for your dogs and cats. I hear many dogs listen to this show. That's really good. So, yeah, and we're, you know, from off-kilter to kilter. Kilter means order and good condition, but it's usually referenced as off-kilter. We want to go back to kilter. So again, the awakened power of storytelling and the opportunity for this show, this station, to extend itself. Thank you, Susan and Pacifica. Thank you, Caroline and Aaron. Love the book, All the Water. Oh, she's read it already. How clever. So again, you know, you can have many, many things, you know, or nothing by going to kpfa.org. There's many great things on Palestine history to be educated and informed. The book, All the Water in the World, is highly educational. Microdosing for health, healing, and enhanced performance. Deeply educating. So as part of our skills team, allies, you know, there's nothing more effective in conversing with somebody than to go, did you know? did you know about this? Unless we ask it in a snarky way, nobody minds that. You know, did you know, back to the first Gulf War, that the Kuwaitis were slant drilling oil? No, I didn't know that, you know. So the more we know, the more effective we really are. And we go, right. So to know more, did you know? And I love, you know, quoting Alan Watts as we also entice people. No sense clinging to the rocks that are falling with you. Come on over. Come on over. An invitation. You know, speaking of which, you know, Venus is stationing now. She's so bright, she or he, so bright in the sky after sunset. Do be intimate with the sky world when you step out after sunset, because it's like, oh my God, she's so bright. And she's stationing at 10 degrees Aries, whose image is wise leadership. We go, right, she's about to retrograde to go on a vision quest. She is quintile the U.S. Pluto, right? So it says, you know, how about trying a democracy, team? Democracy or death, take your pick. But I love that Venus is going on a vision quest to find wise leadership within us all, within us all. You know, again, you know, pluckiness, situation so dire we can't afford the luxury of realism. But we do also want to look realistically at how dangerous things are. We, you know, anything, anywhere is everywhere. And we mustn't forget anything. All of our kin in Gaza, all of our kin in Sudan, all of our kin, you know, in drowning places, all of our kin in our family. It's all one ocean. It's all one ocean. You know, and we say, what species would be so crude as to poison collective water supply or to poison the ocean, our great mother? And we go, a species that had lost its mythology of conscious kinship would do that. And so part of our dedication, you know, is again to quicken. We have endogenous receptors within us all for kinship, you know, to quicken that, to feed that, to speak to that. And that's part of our strategy. Whatever we speak to in another is the part of them we're inviting to dance with the corresponding part of ourselves, which is why we want to be discerning and diagnostic, but not judgy, because when we're judgy, we're inviting the least interesting part of somebody else to dance with the least interesting part of ourselves. So we want these skills, these Aikido skills, these practices to embrace, you know, as we head into these wild, you know, and her book, The Hypercane, the drowning, the floods. We just look back to Katrina, you know, and again, where is their effective human response? We go, we can do a lot better. And this station, you know, again, this community of all of us listening, the whole Pacifica network is a community. Who brought what? And it will be increasingly important as we navigate this collapsing world, and then also what shall it give birth to, and how shall we mutual aid? It's why we're all invited to go. You know, all we have is us, but us is quite a lot. Who brought what? And we're invited to, in our own lives, kind of put all the different chapters together, which is why I'm currently self-referring to myself as anarcho-entheo-astro-animist. That kind of covers a lot there. But it's the, you know, anarcho-mutual aid, who brought what, kindness. It's Bo, who used to be on YouTube, now his wife is, but he would say, you know, every community, all of us need a kind of affinity group. He said it's about 13 people. You might not know them well, and they're diverse. And he said his, because he lives in the panhandle of Florida, is he said it's about half small C conservatives and the rest is, you know, anarchist hippies and working together. And the model is there's a pothole that needs fixing. And one could go, when's the government going to do this? When's the government going to do this? Or who knows how to do this? Let's do it. And so we want to define things. You know, what is the ideal role of government? My dad was a New Deal guy working with FDR long before I was born, but it's in my heritage blood, to really design that. And what is the world, since it's all collapsing, and how do we reinvent it? And that's why we want, you know, what this show has been dedicated to, which is anything we need to know to have a democracy. What a good idea. How do we learn from animals, from our flora, fauna, kin? What are wise models of leadership? Because no other species on this planet, pretty darn sure, would outsource leadership to those who cared nothing for the well-being of the community. Maybe on occasion some hierarchical baboons, but they didn't live long. You know, it's insane. And so we want to, you know, humbly cooperate with nature's guiding genius. And that's also where the animals and the plants and the plant solutions and the entheogens, everything's trying to help us out. And that's why we often host those. And thank you, Chris, who pledged for All the Water in the World, a novel by Aaron Kaufel. I'm known as Cheek. Okay, whoop, Cheek. Oops, read your note too late. I'm known as Cheek, so when you mention my name, use that name. KPFA is my noise all day long when I work in my studio. Excellent, excellent. And thank you also, Lori in Santa Venetia. Yes, thank you. Pledge to our loved ones who have gone before. Yes. And those on their way out. So sorry for your grief from your water dragon sister in San Rafael. Yeah, well, you know, in a micro way, I mean, two older siblings leaving pretty close together, it reconfigures the whole family dynamic, and it takes a while to go, and that's true for all of us. That's true for all of us. If there's immediate in our family, but there's immediate in our community, it calls for a reconfiguration. And I love the New Orleans ritual, and I do that because there's some thought that you pray, you work, you guide the recently dead for 49 days, and I go, Tibetan Book of the Dead, kind of gloomy, you know, monsters and chasms and whatnot, and it's like, I'm going to New Orleans, especially since Mardi Gras is coming up, and we have a lot to learn from New Orleans. If the soul of this country had a physical address, it would be New Orleans. We've done so many shows in New Orleans, and it's time to do it again. But I love the New Orleans ritual. You take your morning beverage, say your coffee, before you've had a sip, out, and you make a little circle in the air, and a little cross, a little toss the cup lightly. And then you pour a libation, going, for the beloved dead. And you see who's there, you know, for so-and-so, and for so-and-so. And, oh, Marcelino, you're always shoving to the front of the line. For those whose names are lost in the mists of time, pour a libation. You know, for those whose bones lie beneath and upon this earth, pour a libation. And then you hold the cup up and you go, we, the living, salute you. And you take your first sip of liquid for the day. I like that a lot. I was telling that to my sister, the one who died on February 1st. She never got over her broken heart at the loss of her husband. And I said, you know, well, I do this. And she said, does it work? And I go, does it work? Does church work? I don't know. But now she's the front of the line, and I go, I don't know, Janie, you tell me. Does it work? We're just weaving these connections. And I want to do, again, a shout-out to radio and books. Radio is, here we are in the invisible, speaking to each other. It allows for a lot. TV's got its place, you know, less and less, but it is kind of slimy and distracting, and it's all those guns, light guns, shouting at you, you know, gerrymander a million years ago, four arguments for the elimination of television. Yeah, it's different than film. Television only shows high contrast, so its bias is violence. And I just want to say also, just for our word craft, you know, we are here, you know, crafting all of our skills. And I would just put forth that we rotate so that we don't always use the word fight, that we might sometimes replace it with the word dedicate. When we dedicate, when we pledge, when we dedicate, we win, you know, because, you know, neuroscientists remind us that when we use the word fight, our brain is symbolic and it cascades a lot of like adrenaline. Whatever we say, we get more. Whatever we say, we get more. And learning more and more. I learned a lot from last week's show, Microdosing for Health, Healing, and Enhanced Performance. Pretty good. And something that changed my mind that I'd known but I'd forgotten, right? What must we remember? You know, what has been forgotten that we must remember? And it said, you know, THC suppresses neuroplasticity in the brain. I'm like, oh, huh. Psilocybe mushrooms enhance neuroplasticity in the brain. And then we went off on a long discussion about, you know, that humans, hyper-yang, death frenzy, has increased, you know, cannabis, marijuana, I sort of still like the name marijuana, to have high THC and very low CBD. It's the CBD that does the healing. I'm going back to do half and half, you know. And they said that's why it really is true that, you know, young teenagers, you know, really shouldn't smoke high THC. And I used to be like, no, it's good for... No. Anyway, I learned that. There's a lot in microdosing for health healing, as well as a kind of protocol, which I think is really essential. I think it's a really good companion. Again, that's for a pledge of $150. I think it works well with all the water in the world, right? I think a little microdosing plus knowledge plus kinship plus enhanced pattern perception is a really good idea. So, team, you can pledge any amount, and that is wonderful, and pledge for beloveds, known and unknown, pledge for all that is in danger. We know that pandemics are coming. We know the bird flu, you know, is, you know, and the wonderful book Spillover by David Common, written before COVID, and the virologists are detectives, and they say, you know, here's an ecosystem that's doing well. Then this terrible virus emerges. What's different? Humans. And they just basically come to, you know, pandemics occur when humans despoil the earth and despoil habitat. The second century medical writers said pandemics occur when tyrants are in power. Okay, we go, okay. So we know what's coming at us. We want information. We want knowledge. We want who brought what. We want to create the ecosystems of mutual aid and support. As the old structures are going down, it behooves us to open things up. Thank you, Robert, in American Canyon, pledging for LSD in the mind of the universe. What a good idea, expanding our minds and souls. Yeah, we want all of it. And, you know, I do love astromythology. It is my dedication. I think in its highest, deepest level, it's a guidebook to how to be a fully participatory Earth citizen. It doesn't require belief. It just requires we all have an imagination. We all have a dedication. We all have a woofiness. We all have a love capacity. We all have, you know, our Mercury. We all have a capacity for genius. And right now, you know, Jupiter quintiles Neptune. All the water, all the images, all the metaphors, all the stories, all the guiding wisdom, all the mentors that ever were or will be are here now. So we're on our way out, team. We're doing, we could be doing better. We're doing pretty good. Thank you. Thank you very much. Keeping the show, keeping the station alive, 800-439-5732, or pledging online, kpfa.org. And I do view Fundrive also as a wonderful convivial opportunity. To say, you know, oh, I found this wonderful book, All the Water in the World by Aaron Kafel. Let me share it with people. Here's something that we could all use. I have unconflicted enthusiasm. Enthusiasm is a great word. It means that which makes the divine within us dance. And the microdosing for health, you know, for a pledge of $150, All the Water in the World for a pledge of $150, or any amount you want to give is really super great at any point. Pledge for people who've left. Thank you, condolences and blessings for, you know, three family members in 1 month. February is rough, but it ties us to all of it. And okay, so here we are. We're on our way out. Thanks always to Kirsten Thomas. We have great teammates here at the station. Everybody listening is a great teammate citizen. I'm Caroline Casey. We will reconvene next week. Thank you, team. Woof.